Everyone, this is Joe.
This is Warth.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Nintendo Show Advance, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. I'm still not crazy about that name, but like it implies, we're going to talk about retro things. What we do on this show is we peek back 21 years. We're going to do it semi-chronologically, so that's going to bring us to September of 2001. And fellas, oof, what a time to be alive.
Yeah, lucky to be alive.
So, I'm walking, I'm in school on September 11th, 2001. I'm in high school. I'm walking through the school library to get to my second or third period TV production class. And as I'm walking through the library, I'm seeing the librarian ladies watching TV. And they're just looking at two towers, very tall skyscrapers. I don't know them from any other building anywhere else in the world. And one of them smoking. I was like, oh my goodness, there must have been a fire somewhere. And I sit down in class, and the rest, for the rest of that class period, we did nothing but watch the news as we watched a second plane fly into the World Trade Center, one tower collapse, and then another tower collapse. And it happened within a span of like an hour.
Yeah, about 2 hours.
Yeah.
And it's the South Tower was the second one that was hit, and it fell in less than an hour.
Yep.
The North Tower, the one that was hit first, actually stayed up for about 45 more minutes.
Mm.
And then it fell as well.
I was in homeroom in middle school.
Yeah.
I remembered that nobody knew what these towers were because we're fucking middle schoolers.
Right. And we live in Orlando.
But that didn't stop pretty much everybody in the school to go, oh, I need to call home and go home. This is really traumatic. And so all the kids took this opportunity to go home early. But nobody knew what the fuck it was.
I don't remember if very many of my classmates went home. I don't really remember much else about that day except watching it on TV. And then when I got to, when we actually like dispersed to go to the next class, the next one I had after that was photography. And the photography teacher at the time was like, we're not going to watch any of this. You will always remember where you were on this day. So this period, we're going to do normal photography. And I don't remember anything else about September 11th.
Wow.
I don't either. Just homeroom.
Yep.
And walking through the school going, where the fuck is everybody?
Yeah, I was...
a bunch of kids went home.
Yeah, I guess I was probably like 16 at the time. And yeah, I was in class...
You old people.
Yeah.
High
yeah.
schoolers.
I forget. I remember the class that it happened in. There, I'd heard some rumblings, but heading to, I think it was like pre-calc, that something had happened, and then we got to the classroom, and then they came over the speaker, and said what was going on. The teacher had a TV, and she brought the TV out, and we were told that we were on lockdown, so we stayed there, and it was probably around noon. They were like, if we've alert, your parents have been alerted, if they want to come pick you up, they can pick you up. If they can't, then we have a couple of places you can go to hang out for the rest of the day. I opted to go to the computer lab, and at the time I was really into a website called FARC. FARC is sort of like what Reddit is nowadays. People post links and talk about stuff. And I spent the next 3 hours on FARC in real time listening to internet people like us talk about what was happening. While another monitor had the news feed going. Pretty wild. Pretty wild. As I do just about every year, I went back to that thread and reread it just to kind of like catch up on it. It's chilling. Because everyone was so confused. Nobody really knew what was going on. At first, we thought it was a terrible accident. Then the second plane hits, and it's right. like, it's a terrorist attack, obviously. Like, this is
crazy. Obviously intentional.
Yes. And, you know, there were four planes total. One hit the Pentagon and killed, I think, like 200 people in the Pentagon as well. One was destined for like the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol. You know, here we are 20 years later, and it will get defaced, but not by a terrorist's plane.
Not by a foreign terrorist.
And yeah, that plane was actually brought down by the people on board.
Yep.
Who kind of knew that something was up. All of the planes had phones. So even though there were terrorists, essentially what they had is knives, small pocket knives, and such smoke grenades and bear mace. So they had basically maced the pilots and people in the back. If the terrorists weren't around you, they were just making phone calls to everybody saying what was going on. I think most people thought it was a hostage scenario, I think if everybody knew what the intentions were, they all would have crashed those planes. I just think that it was, they thought this was going to be like, I remember, wasn't it during one of the Olympics, a bunch of Jewish athletes were abducted on a plane?
Yeah, something like that. Where, so, yeah, and nobody expected that this was going to, like, they were turning these planes into projectiles.
Yeah, it's just truly, you know, and I, like, I don't know how much editorializing you guys want to do when talking about this. It's the most important event of our lives.
Yeah, certainly.
Like, I watched, it came out last year in September. National Geographic made a 6-part miniseries about it. Bone chilling. Like, I cried multiple times through it. I couldn't make it through a single episode without pausing it multiple times. It's just horrific. And as much as we spend our time, like, talking about the games and the music and the movies, I love it. It is time travel that we're doing. This is one of those moments that's, like, you know, really puts things into focus, kind of puts things into scope. Like, it's rough. It's very, very rough.
Yeah, and it is going to usher in a period of American history that we're still kind of living through, where we'll have a sort of a backlash to it, where we become much more proactive in the on the world stage in combating these sort of insurgent militant cells of people who would do us harm. But then it'll also cause a period of inflection on American politics and American society, where we think about the type of country and the type of society that we're actually living in. And when we were in the before times, before we got to September 2001, when we would talk about the stuff on the retro show, you know, it's what a time to be alive. It's the grand society. And what happens in September of 2001 makes us think about, like, well, did we really have as great a society as we thought we did? And we'll, you know, as we go here, I'm sure over the next, like, several shows and several months, we'll talk about the sort of things that happen out of this, like the birth of a whole new department, the Department of Homeland Security and the TSA, and what it does just to kind of, like, day-to-day life in America. But we'll also talk about, you know, how it was that, like, pop culture reacted to this and how this was sort of framed as, you know, these were attacks perpetrated by people who hate our freedom and hate us because we love freedom. Like, sure, they also hated imperialism. And not liking an imperialistic nation is no reason to fly a plane into a building. You shouldn't murder people because of imperialism.
Yeah.
But it will cause a more progressive movement in the United States to think about, okay, what is it? Like, what is our position on the world stage, and should we be acting the way we do?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know how much you want. I wrote notes about what I think the key moments that led us to this event occurring. Mm. It's sick and despicable, too, that it's not even, these aren't armies at war. It's not, the death toll is 2,996 people. I mean, that includes the terrorists, so it's more like 2,970 innocent civilians were killed.
Mm-hmm.
A 2-year-old was killed. Pregnant women were killed. 340 firefighters died. Part of the documentary was just this line of firefighters that were about to scale the building to free the doors as best they could. 70% of the deaths were on or above the floor where the first plane hit.
Mm.
There,
and so many deaths after the fact, just like first responders, people dealing with the consequences and the fallout of cleaning up and rescuing people. There are ongoing health issues.
Yeah, numerous people talked about how the firefighters freed them from the doors and to just keep going up, and all of them, of course, passed away, but they saved hundreds of lives. I want to say, I forget which company it was, but in the South Tower, a securities firm had 2,700 employees, and the manager defied the orders and ordered. Like, they were told to stay put until it was determined whether or not what happened in the North Tower was an accident. He said, fuck no, everyone get out right now.
Mm.
He probably saved 2,200 lives then by making that decision and having them leave early because, you know, again, that second plane hits and 45 minutes later, that tower is completely collapsed. They only pulled 20 people alive from the rubble after the building had collapsed. I mean, it's It's horrifying. And like, why did this even happen? Why the fuck did this happen? So I think there's a couple of key points that it traces back in history, and it goes back. I think the most key, most important moment is probably in like the late 80s, when Afghanistan as a government collapses because it's a Soviet, it's a Soviet-funded nation, and this is also the collapse of communism. So the USSR can't prop up all of these other nations anymore. They collapse, and a movement called the Taliban comes in and takes ownership of Afghanistan. You also have an extreme religious... For starters, the Taliban itself is a religious movement. Think about how... I would imagine if, like, the most conservative American churches, Christian churches, decided to just sort of create their own quasi-government and take land. It's essentially what happened in Afghanistan because nobody could control the region. The Taliban takes power. I may be oversimplifying a lot of this, but that's generally what happens. There's a guy, Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden is an even more extreme fundamentalist conservative Muslim, and he has this group called Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda is sort of a military force. So he and by the way, if we're going to point fingers here, there are 19 hijackers, 17 of them are from Saudi Arabia. He is so extreme that even the Saudis don't want to deal with him anymore. But he gets exiled. He gets exiled. He goes to Afghanistan but has his Al-Qaeda group there. And then from there, they coordinate the effort. Like, this has been a big plan of theirs, but apparently it was only about 2 months worth of actual prep work went in. From, we're going to train the pilots, get them ready, and then they're going to do this. And from there, of course, not long after this, America is going to invade Iraq for totally unrelated reasons. And we're also going to invade Afghanistan.
Well, we'll talk about George W. Bush in further retro shows.
And there's this sort of branching theory. Not theory, same theory. Like, you couldn't imagine more opposite people than what Saddam Hussein, who was president of Iraq, or whatever his title was, I'm sorry, I don't know that well. Like, he believed in pan-Islamism, which was the idea that, you know, like, Egypt and China have people that practice Islam. They should come together as a collective. The Middle East, you know, granted, he wants power, he wants to take land, he wants to take out other governments too, but generally he thinks that it should be Islam against everybody else. And it seems like Al-Qaeda's efforts are more like, no, it's fundamentalist Islam, and if you don't practice Islam the way that we think you should, then fuck you, and we're going to strap people with bombs and then send them into your city squares and kill hundreds of people. So, and even before that, what does it ultimately boil down to is that the United States and Saudi Arabia, even though Saudi Arabia hates us, we have this exchange where we give them weapons, we give them this perceived sense of safety, and they keep the oil flowing. America, ultimately, this boils down to an economic agreement between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Again, this is all starting to get maybe a little too political. We probably shouldn't talk about that any further, but that's why it happened. It's not that any nation, it's not that anybody in Islam hates America for its freedom. You know, that's such a naive way of thinking.
It was a way to sell a sort of pragmatism to people.
They hated us kingmaking over there. Mm. They hated our involvement. They wanted us out of there. And they understood that if it weren't for oil, we want nothing to do with them.
Huh. So still, no reason to hijack a plane and murder people. You know, should we be involved in the politics of any other nation? No, we shouldn't. No reason to kill anybody about it.
Absolutely. It's truly despicable. It's the only way they knew that they could really get to us, and sure enough, it caused wars that would kill millions overseas. You know, if the idea was that this was going to improve Islam on the world stage, fuck no, it did not. And in fact, it would destabilize everything over there. And I'm probably won't be doing this in 15 years, but if we were doing it in 50 years, we'd be talking about something called the Arab Spring, which completely reshapes the Middle East. You know? I'll stop there. This is horrifying. We can talk about this more later and what the immediate aftermath into October and November.
Yep. Because there's stuff coming. We already talked about the Department of Homeland Security. We'll talk about the Patriot Act. My goodness, shit's gonna get weird. But video games, fellas.
It feels like wrong transition into video games after that.
No, we need escapism. We need to be somewhere else right now after all that.
What we're going to witness in terms of things like pop culture, video games, movies, music, television, you know, there are these sort of entertainment media that are quicker to react. Like television is much quicker to react to this sort of thing. But we'll start to see...
the breaking news scroll on every new 24-hour news channel will become a thing out of this.
We'll see the sort of the cultural shift in music and movies and video games as time goes on.
So which game got delayed into oblivion over this event?
That's fucking wild that you say that. The Advance Wars came out September 10th.
September 10th in North America. It got delayed in Japan and Europe. It got delayed. I think in Europe it released later that month. And in Japan, I'm going to do some fact-checking for a different show, but I think like it didn't release in Japan until they did an Advance Wars 1 and 2 dual pack.
This series has got the worst luck. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a cursed series.
Noted C-tier game.
Yeah,
C-tier. Franchise. We talked about this already.
Yeah, yeah.
I re-listened to that. I got heated with you guys about that.
Yeah, you got angry, man.
And it's weird, because I think we all sort of fell in the same general area. Like, would I like Xenoblade and Fire Emblem 3 A-tier?
No, sure, I remember. Wes was like, we're putting one of the fucking things in S-tier. I was like, I disagree strongly.
No, but we'll...
Let's debate, sir.
You just immediately changed my mind on that, because I got better...
Just because we put something in a certain tier now doesn't mean it will stay there. Like as we put,
I harped way too much on sales.
Well, see, what will happen is once we start like adding more things to it, well, it does need to be pyramid shaped. We cannot have everything loaded into S and A. The majority of games need to be in the B and C tier.
The correct way of pyramid. I thought you were talking about an upside down pyramid.
Right. I know what you're saying.
All S's.
Yeah. Everything's
an S.
Hey, if half are S and half are F, you get to the middle there, don't you?
Okay. Where are we going to put arms, fellas? No, we're not doing tier rankings.
Hourglass, all right.
Tier rankings.
Oh, we don't have an SS tier yet, do we? We'll just escalate that one.
We do not have S plus yet, no.
Okay.
Let's
talk about some games. Let's talk about the games.
Do you guys want to start with Advance Wars, since we already brought it up?
Absolutely. Okay. I love that game. It's a great game.
Developed by Intelligent Systems, published, of course, by Nintendo. This was like the main event. This was the big game for Nintendo systems in September of 2001. And what a game. Like, this game is fucking next-gen handheld tactics game. This game is really, really good.
Yeah.
Anyone uninitiated, it is a sort of modern take on a tactics game. You're fighting with infantry units and tanks, weapons of war, modern weapons of war. And it is on a grid. It is turn-taking. You take turns... with your opposing unit, where you move all of your troops and then they take a turn and move all of their troops, or as many as they want. There is an economy to it. You're able to produce units.
Yeah, you take bases, and the more bases you have, the more money you get. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you have these little spawn points where you can spawn everything from low-grade infantry into tanks. You can anti-air planes. You can get hangars, spawn planes.
And then tons of different units from different types of infantry to different types of tanks and area units. And everything has, like, a counter to it. Yes. So there's not just, like, one unit where if you start producing these, you will definitely win. As the series goes on, there are more and more powerful tanks. But what they sort of do to counterbalance things with more firepower and armor is they have less mobility. They will have less ammunition.
Yes.
There's definitely a
resource, so you can't just have units out there forever. They will basically be on a timer for how many turns they last if you don't refuel them.
Right.
And even the things that refuel them are themselves on timers and need to be refueled.
Yeah, so you could have mobile units like APCs. They can carry infantry, but they can also do things like restock ammunition and restock fuel. And... other than using an APC, if you put a unit onto a friendly territory for a turn, it will restock. And also, for a little bit of cash, it'll repair itself a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's a way of keeping, like, your current units, if you have the resources, like, pull them back a little bit and advance fresher units and kind of keep the waves coming.
Also, it's one of those interesting things where, I mean, I'm sure you've had those battles in it where it's like, you don't want to deal with the micromanaging. You feel like you're in a rout and you're going to win. And you're like, all right, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm not going to spawn units. And you're like, wait a minute, I might not do this. And then you realize, the fast five turns, If you're not reinforcing your stuff and keeping this this aggression, this wave up, you may find yourself back to square one.
Yeah, and if you get into a habit of like, no, I'm just going to, I've captured this amount of territory, I have this many bases, I'm going to keep on spawning the most powerful things to kind of keep advancing. If you're not also bringing infantry into the mix, you're not going to be capturing more bases. And it's as much a war of economy as it is a war of troops fighting each other.
Oh, yeah. You need to make exchanges in units. Mm-hmm. You need to basically say, like, I need to take out this thing that costs 7,000, but I want to do it with 4,000 worth of units. And if I do that, that's the key to winning the game.
Yeah, and then once you kind of reach that tipping point where I have 50% of the territories plus one, then it's important to keep that momentum moving forward. Because at that point, like once you get to that tipping point, you have the momentum on your side because you're going to be allocating more resources per turn than the opposing
force. Or if you're just constantly spawning infantry and surrounding their strongest tanks, then every single time they shoot a bullet, they waste a turn. And if it costs 18,000 to make that unit and they've got 10 shots, it just takes 10 1,000 units and you've made a win.
But that's the thing.
You literally just drained this thing of ammunition, Zach Brannigan style.
You can really you can really pester the most powerful units just into just like in pure annoyance. You can keep heavy forces back just by clogging the drains with all these forces. That's like a weird way of thinking about it because you're using your infantry troops just to kind of like lay down in the road and say keep them from advancing.
All the cowards keep exploding.
But it's an effective strategy. There is multiplayer in this game. And I did play a multiplayer match in the DS version, not in this version. But I played a multiplayer match against a friend of mine at a place I used to work. And it was a small map, very like heavily forested. And I would just spawn the mechs, the bazooka units, in mass. And eventually it got to the point where like he would try to like bring in tanks or like more powerful stuff to kind of take out some of my units. But I had so many of them, just got overwhelmed. He couldn't kill me fast enough.
Yeah. It's a game. It's a really, really fun strategic game. It's a chess game. It's like, imagine if there was actually just a chess game that let you spawn chess pieces at a certain value. Like, it's that kind of game. It's so fun.
Yeah.
And yeah, and like you're saying, it's certain units are good in certain capacities and they're terrible in others. Like, again, if all you're spawning is bazooka guys and your opponent's got, you know, nothing but bombers, you simply cannot touch them.
Right. You can't win.
You will never touch anything on. But if all you're doing is spawning those like 22,000 jet planes, then they can't do anything. Then it's two units that can't even fight each other.
Yeah, it's finding a balance to your battlefield where you can effectively advance, but also effectively counter what they're throwing at you.
Yeah.
Robust single-player campaign. Yeah. A lot of introductory missions are sort of your tutorials, and as you go.
But they had CEOs at the time. This game had CEOs. So you had the different powers and stuff that you could do with the individual fighters. And
right, and they introduce you to those CEOs through the campaign where, you know, you start with Andy, and he's kind of your
all-purpose everything guy. I think his power was to, like, heal everything a little bit.
Right, so once, when you engage in combat enough, you fill up this meter. And you fill up the meter both by, like, taking out enemy units as well as your own units getting destroyed. And once it's filled up, you can unleash your CO power. And it'll be different depending on who your CO, your commanding officer, is. So Andy will give, like, a +2 to repair to every unit on the field. So you can give yourself... And also refill, like, fuel and ammunition, I think.
Yeah, what a great power.
So, yeah, really good at sort of revitalizing your forces if you're stuck. There's also... Sammy, who's one of your Orange Star commanding officers,
her power is infantry. She has overpowered infantry, underpowered tanks.
Right, she also captures buildings faster.
Captures them faster, and I believe if you use her superpower, her power, she gets one extra movement out of each unit. That's every infantry unit. So she can, if you position your pieces just right, she can very quickly just take over the map.
Yeah, so in addition to having like these special powers, like you were saying, they also have like just general advantages and disadvantages. So a character like Max will have underpowered range units, but really overpowered tanks.
Yeah.
And then like the inverse of that is Grit,
who has amazing range stuff, but then
his close combat isn't very good at all. And like it even gets to the point where like not only is his range units more powerful, but they also just have like one extra block of range space.
He is simultaneously the most frustrating one to play with, but seemingly overpowered. Mm. I think him and I don't even is Colin in this game?
Yeah, Colin's in this game.
Colin is the other one that's truly like they. What the fuck were they doing there? That's so crazy that he's that powerful.
You see, he's the one where
for two stars, he will double the amount of money he has. Is it double or 1.5 times?
I'm not sure.
And then when his max star, the amount of money you have applies a multiplier to how much damage you do.
Right.
So he's the one that kind of takes the most, like, you have to have the best nuance and feel for the game. But if you get him just right, where you're cheaply, you're constantly multiplying your money and buying the right units, and then when it's really time to strike and you charge that whole thing up, and you've got double, triple times the damage you should be doing, it's a rout. The game's over. Like,
so we talked a bunch about these CEOs. There's four different factions. Five factions, because one of them is the antagonist. But and these four factions will have, I think, like three, maybe four commanding officers in each one. And throughout the single-player campaign, there are points where you can choose which one you want to go with, or there are points where you're, like, you're funneled into, okay, we're going to teach you how to use this one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's Eagle, who does planes, Olaf, who does weather. There's a boat guy, right, in there, like a captain, a sea captain.
That might also be Olaf.
It is also Olaf, okay. I'm trying to think. Is it the Black Star ones? I remember all of them being kind of bad.
There's the Black Hole ones, and I think you can play as those in, like, the War Room, because there's this whole, like, in addition to a campaign, there's the War Room, which just gives you all these maps. You can kind of set
up to where... you can go for, like, top rankings in them and shit, which bases on, I think, the damage you do, how quickly you do it, and how much damage you take, and how many units you lose.
Yeah, it breaks it down to, like... power speed technique is what they call it, that last one.
I remember the very first one, I thought I was going to be so fucking clever, and I did this little sneakeroo attack where I didn't damage a single unit by one hit point, but I was able to sneak an APC there and capture his base with just my inventory, and I got, like, perfect stat, 0 stars for damage. I didn't do any damage. I was like, oh, what the fuck? I feel like I should get an award for that.
And you get a B.
And they give me a freaking B. You know? Like, are you kidding me? That was bloodless war.
Yep. so good. You got anything else about this? About Advance Wars?
Oh, it's a fun game. I really enjoy it, especially if you're the type that likes tactical things. The problem is, like, sometimes these fights take a long, long time. You may be the type that obsesses over the fact that you've got 22 units to move. And then you really have to sit there and think about optimally what is the order of turns for fucking 22 units.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there with each piece and measuring out where it can move.
And you can, like, test everyone's range. You can look at the enemy's range, so you can kind of move them to where you're baiting them into attack, but then also not putting yourself in danger. They're territorial or terrain effects where, you know, if you're, like, in Fire Emblem, if you're on, like, some trees, you'll have a buff to your defense. If you're on a friendly building, you'll get a whole lot more defense.
Actually, it's a buff to avoidance.
In Fire Emblem. In Advance Wars, it's to your defense.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
Okay.
I mean, you can climb, like, infantry can climb mountains, but tanks can't. I mean, yeah, there's all kinds of fun little nuances like that. Again, some people would watch this and think this is paint drawing. They would think this is the boringest fucking game. I love it. I love these kind of tactical, think about what you're doing chess match style
games. I like tactics games, but I couldn't get into this one.
And it's funny because when we talk about, like, Game Boy Advance games or handheld games in general, we're talking about things like, oh, well, it's just like a quick game, you get through it quickly, really good for car rides. This is sort of the inverse of that, where, yeah, it is good for trips, but you're not working your way through it quickly. It's good for trips because you are able to, like, put all your attention into it and, like, look up and realize, oh my god, I've been on the road for an hour, mm-hmm. and I went through a mission.
Yeah.
What else you got? Super important game. Advance Wars. It was a big success in North America and inspired Nintendo to bring over not only this continuing series, it'll get a sequel and then a couple of games on the DS. It'll get a spin-off series on the GameCube called Battalion Wars. But it also inspired Nintendo to bring over other tactics games like Fire Emblem. And Fire Emblem, which is a big, important series to Nintendo now. And without the...
Noted barely scraping the B tiers.
You're gone. Without the success of Advance Wars, you don't get Fire Emblem. And without the success of Fire Emblem, I don't think maybe we see as much Xenoblade as we see. So there's this cascading effect of the success of Advance Wars. I think the success of this game is really well-deserved.
We're never going to see another one.
It's really sad, I know. Very, very frustrating. It reviewed super well. It sold well. Yeah, really, really great. Well, I guess we'll keep it with the Game Boy Advance. There are some Game Boy Color games that came out, but we'll backtrack to those in a second here. Let's keep it next gen. Tetris Worlds came out. Oh, wait, no, sorry. That's, no, I'm right. My notes are wrong. Tetris Worlds came out on the GBA on September the 5th. This one was developed by a company called Radical Entertainment and published by THQ. Radical Entertainment was a development studio that mostly worked on licensed games. They got bought out twice. I think one was by, like, Vivendi. And then the second time they were bought out by Activision, who just ruins everything, especially in the early 21st century. So they went defunct. I think it was in 2007. They will not be missed. But Tetris Worlds, it sure is Tetris. There are a couple of new tweaks, a couple of new modes. One of them is Cascade Mode, where when you get, you know, the line elimination, there's a fallen block effect that will then... You see this a lot in, like, match puzzle games now, where, like, things will fall into place and fill in more lines for you and eliminate more. There's also a mode called Sticky Mode, where blocks will stick to, like, similarly colored blocks. So this, in this sort of mode, the Tetrominos won't necessarily fall in single colors. So, like, sometimes half of them will be green and half of them will be yellow. And if you drop the green part on green blocks, the yellow will become detached and fall further down. There's an atom mode, where sometimes you're just playing like a regular game of Tetris. Single square Tetrominos, I guess they're not really Tetrominos, will fall into the field of play. And those are indestructible. But what they'll do is they can still fill in a spot for you, and it will kind of add to that sort of cascade effect, because they can't be destroyed. They'll just continue to fall to the bottom and keep the cascade effect going for you. It does have multiplayer, presumably through the link cable, of course. Sold almost 1 million units, which isn't too shabby, but, you know, it's a pretty far cry from their Game Boy, the original Game Boy game.
Yeah, so fucking, what, probably 30 million units, 100 million units, who knows?
But you can get a used cart to this one for like $25.
I think it's interesting to note that I didn't play this game at all, so I mean, I played a bunch of Tetris games, love them, they're great. But Game Boy Advance was the first one to get it. Normally, I feel like Nintendo properties are the last in line. We got this one before Windows got it.
Yep.
PlayStation 2 got a copy, the GameCube gets one, and Xbox, so like, for whatever. I mean, I guess maybe that's why. Maybe they're like, of course, the original Tetris sold so well on the Game Boy, they're like, you know,
yeah,
kind of owe this to you.
At the time, maybe sort of viewed like, okay, well, this is a, it's a new handheld system. Let's get the handheld game Tetris onto it. Yeah, and then we'll focus on some other things after the fact. But yeah, definitely did not see the same mega success as Tetris did on the Game Boy. But I don't know, like, thinking about, like, is this game, like, next gen? I don't know. Maybe. It's kind of hard to judge. Like, it's Tetris. It's kind of like unknown quantity. They tried to mix some things up, but how much do you really need to mess with Tetris? Let's see. A couple of beat-em-ups.
Yeah.
X-Men Reign of Apocalypse came into the Game Boy Advance.
I had never even heard of this one. I was just looking at it. Got bad reviews.
Yeah, I think it might be a little bit unfair. I haven't played this one. I have watched some video of it. It doesn't seem all that bad.
Yeah.
And I think, like, the poor reviews of this one might be a product of the genre sort of being out of vogue at this point. Because we haven't really seen, like, very many real beat-em-up games. We see a ton of beat-em-up games now in 2022. But in 2001, like in the mid to late 90s and into the 21st century, we hadn't really seen very many of these games since, like...
Because it was all fighters. People wanted, like, fighting games and stuff.
Yeah,
like,
and it was more about action games now rather than these arcade beat-em-ups.
Yeah. Is the other one that you're going to bring up this Final Fight 1?
It is.
Okay.
Stand by.
Oh, sorry.
Because, yeah, there's a few more things that I want to talk about for X-Men.
Sure.
So, playable characters, you get Wolverine, you get Cyclops, a couple of the ones you'd expect. You also get Storm, who's not often playable, and you also get Rogue, who is hardly ever playable in a lot of X-Men games.
But in a beat-em-up, I think Rogue would fit right in. A beat-em-up. She's just gonna go in and punch people.
She's in Marvel vs. Capcom 2.
Okay.
She's amazing too. She steals powers from people.
I think she does that in the comics too. How about that?
Could you believe it? That's pretty cool that she does that.
But when
is she trailer trash in the comics too?
Oh yeah, certainly.
Oh, fantastic.
Mississippi trailer trash. usually when they like need like the tanky brawler character in these X-Men games,
Colossus, probably.
They're usually going Colossus. Sometimes they'll use Wolverine for that role, but yeah, Colossus typically your big beefy person. If you guys get a chance, and if you can find some video of it, the character animations for Rogue, she has this ridiculous strut. Like she's walking down the catwalk as she's going through these levels and beating up Sentinels. It's so fucking funny. It's gold. But these characters kind of behave the way you think they would. Wolverine is good for close combat. He's got his claws. He's got Mr. Pointy Hands. Cyclops has his optic blast. Storm, instead of using lightning, kind of chucks out tornadoes at enemies. It's kind of fun.
I'm watching Storm right now.
And then Rogue has a charge attack. She can kind of do a dash forward.
I mean, this doesn't look very good, though. I mean, looks fine, I guess.
There were, I feel like, some fun X-Men games on the Super Nintendo.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, like,
so
it would depend on what you're expecting out of a beat-em-up.
I mean, we just got done playing Turtles in Time, so, I mean, that came out on Super Nintendo, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that looks better than this.
Like, visually speaking?
Just in general. Just general gameplay and stuff.
I don't know if I could agree there. Like, I haven't played this game. I don't want to pass any judgment on it, but in Turtles in Time, don't get me wrong, really fun game. You punch and you jump.
Yeah.
And in this X-Men game, you punch and you jump, and you shoot lasers out of your eyes. It's an optic blast, not a laser. Neither here nor there. It has like an Age of Apocalypse setting, but it's not like the Age of Apocalypse that we know it from the comics that kind of invented their own. And I know this because they showed some of the bosses that you fight. You can fight Blob, also Gambit and Nightcrawler. Gambit and Nightcrawler are not villains in the Age of Apocalypse storyline. There are 12 stages. At the end of each stage, you gain points that you can invest into different stats, like your strength and your durability, that kind of thing. It does also have multiplayer. You can have two people going with the link cable, of course.
Two whole people.
I know, right? You know, the X-Men as characters, just like the Ninja Turtles, they're really well suited to a beat-em-up. Like, these characters, like, because they all kind of do their different things, they have their own personalities that are just kind of easily implied based on the way that they're behaving or the powers that they have. The game doesn't take long. About a 45-minute run time to get through all 12 levels.
Oh, they're doing the Wolverine thing where he's pretty much just, like, almost on the ground as he runs around and moves.
Yeah, hunched over.
It's, like, hunched over, like, a little.
That's very reminiscent of the Marvel vs. Capcom movements and playstyle of Wolverine.
Yeah, this game, like you were saying, Wes,
it's kind of growing on me as I'm watching this.
I mean, it seems fine. At some point, I think I might grab a ROM for this one and give it a shot. Oh, and you can do things like... Wait, no, sorry. I'm thinking about the next game. Used cart will set you back for like $35. That doesn't seem worth it. I mean,
but if you can find a ROM.
Yeah, why not? The other beat-em-up that came to the Game Boy Advance was a port. It was a port of Final Fight 1. The port was done by Suntech and, of course, published by Capcom. So, unlike the Super Nintendo version, you can pick from all three characters from the arcade version.
Hell yeah.
Super Nintendo version didn't have Guy in it.
Yeah.
And they released like a version after they released Final Fight on the Super Nintendo. It was just Final Fight Guy, where you could play as Guy. And that was the game.
I mean, even with him, I always thought he was kind of the boring one of the three.
I mean, his name is Guy.
Yeah. I mean, it's just his play style. And yeah, given the name, you'd think they could have done better.
What kind of parent needs to be so lazy that they're just, I don't know, name them
They could have just, like, looked at that Super Dodgeball game and picked up any one of those names.
Know, right?
Like Dude or Dirt.
It's not even, like, short for something. Like, what's his full name? Guy Follow You? Like, I don't...
Maybe we're mispronouncing. Maybe it's actually Guy. It's like Guy.
Guy LaDouche. Did you guys ever watch that Most Extreme Elimination?
No.
Fucking amazing. Yeah, and there's, like, the... There's this Japanese game show that was basically like Wipeout, kind of like what American Wipeout
did. Sure.
Oh, God.
Yeah, yeah.
And they would dub it, call it Most Extreme Elimination, and then the dub would just be fucking hilarious because they would make up two separate teams. So it would be like, you know, one team would be like Catholic clergy versus prostitutes. And they would just redub everything. It was, oh my god, it was killer. It was so fucking funny. Nice. Oh, but then the on the scenes guy that they always cut to, his name and it says it in the bottom is like Guy LaDouche. So it's like Guy the Douche. Yep. Oh, it's just so good.
Perfect. Let's see. Oh, Guy and Cody introduced to Hagar are in the game. Guy and Cody even have some different sprite options. So apparently they were also in the Street Fighter Alpha series. So they took the sprites from Street Fighter Alpha and put them in this game so you can play through.
I remember Cody from that has, it's cool because he's like in shackles. He's been arrested, right? And he's got the white and blue stripe, like prison outfit thing going.
I mean, he's a little bit hunched over like Wolverine.
Yeah.
Let's see, it is a bit of a zoomed-in view when compared to the Super Nintendo or the arcade version. The GBA has a lower resolution screen. That's understandable. They are able to get more enemy sprites in the GBA version compared to the Super Nintendo version, which is pretty cool. Also, in the arcade, there's an industrial area, which did not make it into the Super Nintendo version. That's back for the GBA port here. 5 difficulty options, which is cool. And you couldn't save between stages, which is great.
How about that?
Yeah, that's really, really great because, well, you know, if you're playing this game on a car ride, of course, you reach the end of a stage and like have to exit the car because you've reached your destination. You're not going to lose your progress. Multiplayer, like we mentioned before, via the link cable, is a really cool return of a classic beat-em-up. This one, it's interesting. You mentioned like Tetris Worlds coming to console. It's interesting, kind of a shame that this one didn't come to home consoles because it's a much easier way to play these multiplayer games, these beat-em-ups.
Yeah.
But it's a pricey cart, upwards of $90. Yikes.
That's kind
of,
yeah, huh.
You can play this game, not like this version of the game, but you can play Final Fight, the arcade version, and that Capcom beat-em-up bundle. It's a much better option if you want to play through the original Final Fight. But that's all I got for GBA games. You guys got anything that you brought for the retro games?
We might want to. This is a content loaded month. If you want to move these two games to the next month, I got two that I think are worth mentioning.
Let's get through the games. I have some Game Boy Color games I'm going to blast through. But let's kick it over to you. For what you got?
September 30th, PS2 released Ico.
Yep, sure did.
Holy shit!
That's one of your games, aren't you? On your list to bring up, anyways.
Yeah, yeah. Developed by Team Ico, published by Sony.
Yeah. Really. One of those games that makes you think games don't have to be the way they are.
Mm.
You know? Really cool action kind of puzzle game with just these incredible environments.
That was the big thing about
this game. Cerebral game.
Yeah, yeah, because the crux of the gameplay is that you are in this environmental zone. Really interesting architecture, really interesting structure that you're working your way through. And you just kind of have to like move things around and interact with the environment to find like how to open up the exit or how to climb up the thing to get you to your next area.
And so much of the game is the thing that people say they hate in games, which is an escort mission.
Right. There are times where you like have to actually hold the other character by the hand and drag her along to where you need to go.
Yeah. I love this game. It's all atmosphere and environment, and it's a great reminder that not everything needs to be a shooty-shoot.
Yep.
That not everything needs to be an action game.
And that there is, like, some combat to it, and it's...
Oh, yeah, there is, certainly.
It's a bit clumsy. It's not great. So, like, what you're looking forward to is getting to, like, your next zone so you can see, like, the next really impressive set piece that they're presenting to you. And I think there are points in the game where you're not doing an escort, where you get separated.
Mm-hmm.
But this game was directed by a guy, Fumito Ueda. I'm not going to get into his career or his rising through the ranks of Sony right here. He's kind of like this weird, interesting dude. Sony really took a chance on this guy. And like with this game, Shadow of the Colossus really paid off. He also directed that game, The Last Guardian, which is a really interesting but really flawed game. Hopefully he's able to rebound whatever his next project ends up being. Like you were saying, most of the puzzle games are simple enough, but moving through the world is just sublime. The controls are wonky, a little bit clumsy at times, not like perfectly responsive the way you'd want them to be. But in like a sort of weird way, it kind of adds to the charm, where sometimes you're kind of fighting the game and fighting the girl you're trying to escort in order to accomplish the thing you want to accomplish. But that sort of like adds something to it. There's just like a sort of... a weird sort of inverse intuitiveness where you would think like a game that you had to fight against, you just get frustrated and want to just put it down. But they hit on something like really hard to describe, like why it works as well as it does, even though the game isn't like as buttery smooth functional as you would think of something like its contemporaries, like a Wind Waker or something like that. It's similar like to they do a similar thing in Shadow of the Colossus, where the character is a bit unwieldy, jumps a little bit floaty, the horse doesn't control particularly well, but when you're actually able to do things successfully, it feels really great. And when bad things happen to the characters that you've been fighting against, it feels really shitty. Like that ending in Eco, where like you jump across the bridge and she can't come with you, and it's bad. Bad things happen.
I didn't know the ending of Eco. So he just leaves her.
Yep, they get separated.
They just fucking end it there. Like that doesn't.
Yep. But this game was reviewed extremely well and well deserved. What a game! This game is really good.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You get a used copy for the PSD for $50.
Totally worth it.
I have a copy. I didn't know it was like that.
Yeah, I got a copy too. Mm-hmm. They did a HD collection for PS3 with this and Shadow of the Colossus. You can get that for the same price if you just want to experience the game and get another game with it. Yeah. Shadow of the Colossus is also another really good one. Yep. We'll get to that someday.
That game is so good. Oh,
you got anything else for Eco? Ico?
That's it. That's it for Ico.
Cool. What's your other one?
Silent Hill 2.
Yep.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Love me some Silent Hill 2. Konami.
Oh, dude. You've played this. I haven't played this one.
Really? I mean, it's been a long, long time, but yeah, I remember back in the day I was playing through all like the Resident Evil and Silent Hill 2 games.
It's a similar sort of structure, like a similar sort of concept to Resident Evil, where you're working your way through like an environment, this town that you're in, you're kind of finding keys that open doors. I was watching a bunch of gameplay of it earlier today. It doesn't seem like it, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I have a misunderstanding of what this game is. It doesn't seem like you get into like the sort of inventory management or the sort of complexity that you would see in a Resident Evil, where you need to be carrying the exact right item at the exact right time in order to work through the most efficiently.
Yeah, I did generally. I mean, it's been a long, long time since I played it, so it's not fresh in my mind at all. But yeah, this is very much more of the survival horror, less a action survival horror kind of Resident Evil style thing, where you're constantly fighting things and getting your weaponry and arming up. But this is, yeah, very much just like, you know, just try to survive, keep pushing through like all of the just absurd and insane things that happen in it.
Pretty iconic characters in Silent Hill 2. You got Pyramid Head.
Yep. There's the nurses in there. Yep. And I remember that's what, I don't remember who created the game, but I believe that's what had happened is a lot of the inspiration for the artwork and everything is drawings that were made from people in asylums describing their nightmares.
Oh shit, okay.
Which makes this kind of surreal bend to all of the different things. It wasn't like he just sat there and made these up. These were actually taken from the dreams of schizophrenics.
Huh.
So there is definitely this subconscious layer to every bit of... And knowing that's there makes everything else just seem that much more unnerving, that this was literally a part of someone's dream.
Yeah.
So, wild stuff. I mean, I love the series. I kind of wish I had done more prep work for this. I really... With all of the research that I felt like I had to do in September, it kind of just escaped me to look at the games.
Well, just the sort of high-level stuff, developed by Team Silent, published by Konami. It's a third-person horror game. You go to this fucked-up town, dude looking for his wife. There's like this omnipresent fog whenever you're in outdoor environments. You also go into indoor environments, like an apartment building is one of the first places you go into. And a lot of the gameplay revolves around finding the key and then finding the place you need to use that key. There's different difficulty settings. You have a little flashlight that you carry around with you for some of the darker areas. It's interesting. The gameplay I was watching through, the guy was describing, like, okay, you can interact with doors once they've been unlocked, but in order to unlock a door, you have to have your flashlight on it. And there are certain enemies where flashlights will draw the attention. So you kind of have to find that balance between, like, okay, do I try to engage with these enemies? Do I try to be stealthy and avoid them? And that's where a lot of the tension of the game, a lot of the horror of the game comes through. Tank controls, similar to classic Resident Evil. Also similar to Resident Evil, you do have, like, fixed camera angles, but the camera is dynamic. It will move around with you. It's not like you have static screens, and when you've left the screen, the camera angle will change drastically. It's more like Code Veronica did this as well.
In a way, it's also kind of navigating you, too.
Yeah.
The kind of camera kind of moves the direction that they intend you to move, generally, so...
You know, true.
Can
true.
Help you out.
So, I've never got any of these games. I've never gotten into this series, which is a shame, because I'd like to. I'd jump all over, like, a collection. If Konami did a collection of Silent Hill games and re-release them on Switch, that'd be really cool. Sold really well, roughly over 1 million units, or about half of Xenoblade 2. Really expensive to get now, even though it did get like the PlayStation 2 Greatest Hits special box.
Yeah,
about $120 for a used copy with just the disc.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
wow!
Didn't realize this was that valuable. I know I have a Silent Hill game on PlayStation 2. I don't know if it's this one though.
Yeah, another reason why it'd be really great to see a re-release for these. It's just tough to get on the original hardware, and that might have to do with the sort of growing nostalgia for that sort of era of gaming, PlayStation 2, GameCube, you know. We're talking about 2001. Things are officially retro now from 2001.
Is this like how you can get a classic custom license plate for a car that's like from 1989?
Oh, can you really?
I forget what it is. I think it's like a 25-year thing.
Huh.
Or what? I forget how long it has to be, but it's like... You can get classic custom plates on cars that are not that old.
Right. anything else about Silent Hill 2?
No. Nothing here.
Cool. I'm going to blast through these Game Boy Color games real quick. These might be the last of the Game Boy Color games before we officially close the book on that system. First one, Wendy, Every Which Way. That was on the Game Boy Color sometime in September of 2001. Kind of a nebulous release date for this one. This one, developed by Way Forward and published by TDK MediaActive. Way Forward still making games. TDK MediaActive went defunct. They got folded into 2K when they got bought out, went defunct. Way Forward is a game developer, like I said, still exists. They go on to develop the Shantae series, Contra 4, A Boy and His Blog remake, most recently games like River City Girls. We know them. We love them. Friends of the show. The title character, Wendy, is a character from the Casper the Friendly Ghost series. So it's sort of a licensed game. And this game was supposed to be a tie-in for an animated reboot of a Casper series that fell through, never came out. They released the game anyway, despite the publisher trying to outright cancel it. Way Forward was able to actually get them to release it. It is a mostly side-scrolling action game, where you have four worlds and three side-scrolling levels in each world. And then the fourth level is a horizontal shooter, where Wendy jumps on her witch broom and shoots things that are coming at her.
Yep, like just, yeah.
And it's pretty rudimentary. You run and jump through levels. You beat up enemies with a little projectile that you launch out of your magic wand. You collect stars from defeated foes, and you use them to upgrade your range and your attack power. So the twist on the gameplay comes from the ability to change the sort of orientation of gravity. By pressing up on the D-pad, you invert the environment, and sort of just represented by Wendy now sticks to the ceiling as if she were sticking to the floor. And then when you press down on the D-pad, reverts it back to a standard orientation. And this mechanic is used primarily for platforming puzzles. There's a jump too high. You can't actually make a jump. You invert yourself and just walk along the roof to overcome that obstacle. You also use it to defeat certain enemies. There are like these pig enemies where, you know, when you invert, it also inverts their gravity, and when they fall into the floor or slam into the ceiling, it stuns them. So, by most accounts, it is not a particularly challenging game. It makes sense, sort of licensed from a kid's property. But it seems to have offered like a fun, breezy experience for kids. It has some nice, chunky sprites for a Game Boy Color game. Best of luck finding it. Upwards at $100 from some auction sites.
Yowzer.
God. Not available anywhere else. Moving on to Lufia, The Legend Returns on the Game Boy Color on September the 20th.
Can we do a quick trivia?
Yes.
How did Casper die?
Ooh, how did Casper die?
I do know this.
Oh, okay.
He was out sledding and got caught in the snow and got sick and died.
Oh, how morbid.
He died of pneumonia. That is correct.
Yeah. It's from the movie when they find the sled up in the attic.
Was the sled named Rosebud?
I wish.
That would have been great.
I forget what the sled was called.
Sled was named your mom because he rides it all night.
Hey, oh,
couple hammers.
That's a child.
I know. That's, that's what makes it so nasty.
Oh, it's the guy from Wet Hot American Summer.
Oh, the kid?
It's the kid from... He's Casper.
Gross. Moving on.
That movie went places. Let's see. Luffy and the Legend Returns was developed by Neverland and published by Natsume in North America. Neverland is a game developer founded in May of 1993, and they developed the other two Super Nintendo Lufia games, as well as a few other things, but most known for this RPG series. They also developed a couple of PS2 Shining Force games, as well as the Rune Factory games, before they filed for bankruptcy in 2013, and most of the developers at Neverland ended up being absorbed by Marvelous, who continues to... work on Rune Factory games.
I want to go back to Casper just for one second.
Please, yeah.
Since it's a kid's show, do you think it's good giving him like a dark death like that, or should it have been better, like, not necessarily a funny death, like, oh, a piano fell on him? You know, just something.
Yeah.
Like, how do you think that was the right way to address the child's death in a kid's show?
I think they did the right thing by not focusing too much on his death.
Mm.
You know, by sort of it being like, everybody dies, you know, it's just...
But then they had the Lazarus machine, and they're going to bring him back.
Is that what... I really don't know shit about Casper, honestly.
That was the movie, right? Christina Ricci and Bill Pullman?
Yeah.
I just Googled how did Casper...
I know too much about that movie. I watched it a bunch when I was a kid, so I know a lot about that movie.
The animated series came out in 1945.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, very old.
I mean, at that point, like, they probably had no qualms just, like, telling kids, like, yeah, 50% of you might die.
That's the way to deal with it.
I mean, that's just every day.
Where are we? Oh, Natsume. Natsume is the publisher of Luffy the Legend Returns. They're most recognizable as the publisher of the Harvest Moon games. They still publish Harvest Moon games. They own the name Harvest Moon, but not the actual, like, legacy of Harvest Moon. We won't get into that this time.
So you're telling me that this Story of Seasons game that's coming out is not from them?
No, that's not Natsume. That's Marvelous.
Ooh.
Yeah, because the Harvest Moon series got totally fucked up. But yeah, now the sort of like legacy of that series is now called Story of Seasons.
Oh, Story of Seasons, sorry.
Yeah. Why? I thought you said Story of Seasons.
Did I say Story of Seasons?
No,
you said something else.
Play the tape.
Okay.
This game, Lufia The Legend Returns, originally started out as a PS1 game and was being developed by a company called Nihon Flex. They never finished the game and ended up filing for bankruptcy. So the original developer of the series, Neverland, took over but then moved development over to the Game Boy Color. And like most other games in the Lufia series, it's a turn-taking JRPG. This Game Boy Color version of it has more of like a dungeon crawling flavor to the actual dungeons that you go into. It does not have random battles, which is great. You can see all the enemies populating the dungeons, but the dungeons are randomly generated, and that's sort of where the dungeon crawling goes into it. So rather than having like these crafted dungeons, like actual puzzles that you solve in order to advance through it, you have just rooms with enemies to kill in it until you get to the end. The fights are turn-taking, similar to Suikoden, where you command all of your units and then they execute their maneuver and then all of the enemy units get to go. This has up to a 9-person party in battle.
God.
Yeah, it's crazy. So the way they sort of balance it out is only 3 of your characters get to have a command in a given turn, and then the enemy gets to go, and then you can select 3 characters again.
Do you pick which of the 9 for your 3, or...?
Right. So what you do is you can arrange your party of 9 on a 3x3 grid. And like any other RPG, people in the front row are taking the most damage, people in the back row are dealing the least damage, but are bulkier, or are taking less damage. And what you do is you can only select 1 character from every column.
So there
is some strategy to thinking about, okay, what characters am I going to be using on this given turn, and am I going to be trying to do a lot of damage, or am I going to try to do some setup
in
the background?
That's really interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, it could make for some fun, like, position shuffling. If, like, the battles aren't very in-depth, if you don't have, like, very defined character classes, it could just be annoying that you have to deal with so many things. I have not played this game. I can't say for sure. The visuals remind me a lot of the NES Dragon Quest game, but this this Game Boy Color game probably has more detailed, like, scenery, like, rooms and stuff. There's another Game Boy Color cart that is unavailable anywhere else and is super expensive. Upwards of, like, $200 from auction sites.
Sheesh.
Really, really pricey.
Not a lot of reviews, but none of them particularly positive.
Yeah. Yeah, this is definitely, like,
a... Best review is a 6 out of 10.
This is definitely...
That's sad, because that's a really interesting battle system.
This is definitely, like, a D-tier RPG series.
Hmm. So, I like that battle system. I would like them to go back to that. That's really interesting.
And then the last game, Game Boy Color, came out September 12th. It's Tokitori. This game, unlike the other two Game Boy Color games we mentioned, this game is available in a lot of places, developed by a company called Two Tribes. We've probably mentioned them before. They did Swords and Soldiers on Wii U, also Rive on Switch. That was their last game. They're a really small developer based in the Netherlands. Capcom published this Game Boy Color version of Tokitori. It's a puzzle game where you play as this little yellow chicken that can't do all that much. You can walk and you have a really tiny jump. And each level is an arena. You kind of think of it as like a puzzle room and like a Mario Maker. And what you need to do is you define all of the eggs that are scattered around. But you need to find like the path that's going to get you to all of them efficiently. There's typically like a path that will get you there. And you have these a small pool of really limited skills. You start out with like just being able to build a 2-block bridge. And you need to find out where you need to place that in order to gather all 6 of the eggs throughout the level. And sometimes, like, if you fall down a ledge, you'll survive the fall, but you won't be able to get back up in order to get something you might have left up there. So, there are also, like, different skills you get as the game goes on, like warp through walls. A lot of these puzzles, I've played this game, a lot of these puzzles get really head-scratching. It's a bit esoteric and also pretty bland. Many of the puzzles just are find a way to use your resources to build the most efficient staircase. But, you know, you could pay way too much for a cart if you really wanted to try this game, or you could get it on Switch for like $5, or you could find a much better game on Switch for $5 when it's on sale and download that instead. I don't particularly like this game, but it's a game that's kind of stuck around. And it got a sequel on Wii U, I think it was, that got then ported to Switch as well. But yeah, that's Tokitori. And one last little footnote as far as video games. Phantasy Star Online got an update to version 2. This was an update of a game, Phantasy Star Online. We talked about that before. It was a Dreamcast game. Mm-hmm. It's actually pretty significant that a console game got an update in 2001. It's also really significant that it was for the Dreamcast, because Sega supported this Phantasy Star game longer than they supported the hardware, because the Dreamcast was dead at this point.
Huh. Was there like an ongoing subscription that you had to pay for it?
I don't think it was a subscription, no.
Huh. I mean, it would make sense if they had like a fan base, a dedicated user base, so that were paying a certain amount of money a month or a year to access the game, that they would be worth doing that. But yeah, like if they discontinued the hardware, and that's...
Maybe this was like sort of like a final apology to like the, because this game definitely had a dedicated fan base. Mm-hmm. Hey, we discontinued the hardware, so that's kind of the end of this. Here's the one last update to version 2.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's
quite
that's,
a month.
Oh yes, a ton of games for the month. And God, Advance Wars, game of the month, right there. I'm giving it to. That's our. Oh wait, Eco came out as well. I don't know. I probably spent more time in Advance Wars.
Guys, Casper game.
Oh, that's right. Wendy Every Which Way.
No love for Bass Strike on PS2?
No. Bass Fishing game? I never played the Bass Fishing games.
That's fine.
But that is S tier.
Absolutely it is.
Those Bass games.
Well, you guys want to take a break?
Yeah, we can take a little break.
All right, let's take a break and then come back with some other pop culture stuff from 2001.